Okay, we're recording tape two, side two. I notice here it does say that it was a ruled on soft glass coated with aluminum blazed for the ultraviolet. So, yeah, definitely aluminum coating.
Mm. Okay, where's that? That's
also page 300.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, this sort of implies that it was ruled in the glass.
That's right.
That seems unlikely.
Okay, so that might just be a...
it was probably a Bausch & Lomb replica.
Okay.
Or master. It, if you read it right, it may well be a master grating that was ruled on soft glass after it had been coated with aluminum.
Okay.
And that's probably the most likely thing for it.
On page 302, you are credited with Mr. J.P. Curtis for, quote, skillful help with the optical adjustments and the photometry. I'd like to know if that helps describe what your involvement was, if that sort of jogs your memory a bit.
Well, I don't remember working on the photometry, so it's possible that Barbara Todd or J.P. Curtis worked on the photometry of the film, because I don't recall doing that at all. The only part I can remember working on, I think, was on the... I'm pretty sure I worked on the alignment, and probably worked on the scattered light testing to see that the... there wasn't too much scattered light inside to prevent getting a spectrum.
Mm-hmm. What would you say were the major problems then in spectrograph design during this period? Scattered light has appeared a number of times.
Yeah, I think scattered light is... I guess there are really two major problems. One was having an efficient grating, and that was one that was really not worked on very much, because we probably, for one thing, we weren't all that well set up for testing grating. So I don't remember for sure. Curtis worked on this, he and others, maybe Rentz was instrumental in this, designed a big square tank about 5 feet square and about a foot deep, in which one could set up various experiments, and including a grazing incidence spectrograph, which was set up inside. And so one could do a certain amount of testing on gratings and things like that. And so these gratings may well have been tested for their, probably not in a very good way, but at least partially tested for their reflectivity in the ultraviolet. And but I'm not sure whether they were tested for that or not. But more or less, the main thing that we would work on is trying, as best I recall, is trying to reduce the scattered light, because we would usually end up more or less constrained by whatever gratings we had available.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So, well, that constraint brings up another question, and that it was funding. Were you aware of funding constraints during this time? Were you working on a shoestring, or
not? No, I think that these were relatively well funded. Maybe if one were used to spending more money, one would have felt that there was a funding constraint. But I don't think that anyone at the time that I recall thought that there weren't enough funds available, really.
Okay.
But maybe that was because of lower aspirations concerning the amount of testing to be done, and various things like that, because there probably should have been more work done on improving the quality of the instruments.
Mm-hmm. That's beyond the grating, you mean, the instruments themselves?
Well, and especially with the grating, I would say.
I see.
And
but you really
I think
weren't.
The instruments themselves were probably built well enough.
Mm-hmm. But you really, excuse me, your own team really wasn't capable of improving gratings, was it?
No, but I think that more effort could have been put into actual testing of them to make sure that one had the best possible gradings.
I see. I see. I understand
and
that.
And perhaps spending a little more money on gradings.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Would no doubt have been beneficial.
Yeah. Now, the flight that this was on was December 12, 1952. Mm-hmm. Let me just confirm. Where were you then? Were you back at...
University of Colorado.
Yeah.
And I would have been starting my thesis research at about that time.
Your master's or doctorate?
Doctorate. And I finished my coursework, and I think I took my comprehensives in the fall of 1952. I spent part of the summer, at least a few weeks out of the summer, helping my dad on the farm, maybe mm-hmm. 3 or 4 weeks, because my youngest brother had gone to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I wasn't there all that long. I know I was doing some studying for not very effective, I guess, for my comprehensive exam. I was actually studying nuclear physics while I was helping him. And
for the comprehensive,
which wasn't covered much on the comprehensive anyway, so it didn't do me much good, and I didn't really.
Okay.
So I ended up kind of short of time on studying the proper things.
Do you remember the excitement over that successful flight?
Yeah. I think people were quite excited over that.
Did you go to the flight?
No.
Right?
No.
Okay.
No, I think I was a little bit still. Not interested in getting a clearance, for one thing, and
so you needed a clearance to go to the flight.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. Yeah, so I think I was a little bit against all of the a lot of the secrecy mm-hmm. ideas that were about at that time.
I see. Yeah. But can you give me a sense of the excitement? Recall anything, what people were talking about?
Well, I think there was just a lot of excitement to see something that far in the ultraviolet was the main point of excitement about it. And of course, there was also some excitement about looking at the lines in the. From 2000 to 3000, because I think that these were observed with significantly higher resolution at that time than had been observed in Tausi's flights, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. And this goes all the way from 2000 to 5000 angstroms.
Yeah. So at least I was interested in that part of it. And in fact, I in the summer of 1948, when I was working on the monochromatic camera, I think I had also run across this idea that the light might penetrate deep into the Earth's atmosphere at 2100 angstroms, which certain mm-hmm. French physicists had worked on some years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had suggested or brought that up or something, or suggested it to some people as an interesting thing to see whether the light at 2100 angstroms could reach a mountaintop.
Yeah.
And so they did get some funding for this project, and at the time I started my thesis research, there was the possibility of working on that project that I was considering, and I also saw that the possibility of working on the lines from 2000 to 3000 angstroms and analyzing, making an effort to analyze them,
mm-hmm.
And so I actually decided that what I would like to work on, I think partly because I thought it would be a shorter and easier project, would be to work on the 2000 to 3000 angstrom spectrum. So I talked to Rentz about working on this, and so he came back later and said something to the effect either that I couldn't work on this, or somebody else was going to work on it, or something like that. I don't remember for sure what it was. At any rate, nobody ever worked on it. And this may have been because Pete and Paul wanted me to work on this other problem at 2100 angstroms, which they had gotten some funding for.
I see.
And so I've never known what the reason was for not working on the 2000 to 3000 angstrom spectrum.
I see. So you worked on this 2100 angstrom window, expected window, and what was the result of that? That was your PhD?
That was what I worked on for my PhD thesis. What I wrote my PhD thesis on was photo emission from potassium telluride, and that was a detector which I tried to work out for observing the 2100 angstrom emission from the top of Mount Evans.
I see. Was it potassium telluride?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason for working on that was because this fellow, I think is Alpert at Westinghouse, I believe, David Alpert, had investigated cesium telluride and rubidium telluride and had observed that the wavelengths, that the sensitivity of it, I think, decreased probably as you went to a lighter element, and so it seemed to me that potassium telluride would probably be solar blind, and that is not sensitive above 3,000 angstroms, and so that was the reason I tried to develop a Geiger counter with the potassium telluride on the inside in order to observe the light at 2,100 angstroms. So I did manage to get a detector like that built, and it worked at least after a fashion. It didn't have, I think, as much sensitivity as I hoped it would have it at 2100 angstroms, but it did seem to be relatively solar blind and more sensitive than tellurium itself.
I see.
And so, but I think that probably there's so little... to begin with, there's probably so little light reaching, if any, reaching a mountaintop at that wavelength that it's probably futile to try it.
Okay. I'm curious.
So I never did write anything about the 2100.
You didn't at all.
I probably should have.
Your degree came in 69. Is that correct?
In 1959.
Okay. There's a... this is your own vita here, and there's a misprint.
I see.
Okay. 59 sounds a lot better than 69.
Yeah.
Good. Now I understand. Okay. So, also, just to get this straight, in your previous positions, you worked in the rocket instrument design, University of Colorado Boulder, 49 to 52, and then 57, 58.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened between 52 and 57?
Okay, I spent most of my time on my thesis during those years.
I see. That took a heck of a long time.
Yeah, I did a lot of work on it.
Yeah, and it's never published.
I should have published it, I guess, and I never did.
Okay. Let me go back and ask you a few questions about this spectrogram. On figure one that you have there, it points to where the Lyman alpha line is. Then they magnified that as figure two on the next page, 301.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me where the heck it is? Is it this very thin?
Yes.
So it's this that I'm marking with an arrow right now.
Right.
Okay. Now, from that, were they able to your recollection, get a reasonable intensity for that Lyman alpha line? They have it here.
They have it listed. I don't know how that compares with later results or not.
Okay.
I guess one would have to convert that to the later results. The later result for intensity on Lyman alpha is pretty good. That's about 3.43 ergs per centimeter, per square centimeter per second, is a very reasonable number for Lyman alpha intensity.
3.43. When was that?
That's the...
which paper is
in
that?
In the paper...
That's Aboud, A-B-O-U-D,
yes.
Baring, and Rents, Mission Light Intensities in the Solar Ultraviolet, APJ 130, number 2, 1959, page 381. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now... this
and that's
one.
Kind of a median value of various values that have been measured on the Lyman alpha intensity. And I don't know whether people have really better values than that now or not. I would assume so.
Okay. They don't really say too much here. They have it in microwatts per square centimeter.
Yeah.
And I couldn't convert that.
Yeah. Yeah, it would take a few minutes to do that.
Okay, fine.
I might try that and see what it comes
out.
Yeah,
that'll be quite curious. Well, while you were working on your thesis, did you continue to have contact with, certainly with the Roketson group and in the development of pointing controls?
Yeah, we were always in the same building, so I certainly would keep up with what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is remembering.
Okay,
what
because
I kept up with.
You weren't directly involved with the technology involved in building those pointing controls.
No.
Yeah. But you were around when a number of the people left to form Ball Brothers.
Yes.
What was the sense of their leaving at the University of Colorado group? Mm-hmm. Were there any problems?
Well, I think Jackson, Jim Jackson, was a bit of a promoter in general,
mm-hmm.
and probably a better promoter than physicist, really. And so he and Stacy had apparently they had later on this upper air laboratory became part of the Research Services Laboratory.
Research which, Services.
Yeah. And one of their ideas was to provide research services not only to do this pointing control project, but to provide research services for other people, even industries that might like to have some help in something or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the real motivation for it was, whether it was to try to expand the scope, or because the funding from Air Force maybe wasn't as much as they were hoping for, or what. I don't remember
mm-hmm.
exactly why it was founded, or just the desire to grow. At any rate, there was a company who was making devices called control cells or something to weigh trucks with by putting these little weighing devices between the spring and the axle.
Uh-huh.
And so you could have a sort of a gadget on your dashboard or something that would tell you how much weight you had on the truck.
Hmm.
And apparently these were not working very well, and Ball Brothers in Indiana had somehow gotten involved with this company in a way that I don't remember. And I think that they had actually contacted the Research Services Lab to try to find out why that this company wasn't doing better on producing these devices. So Research Services Lab started working on that, and it wasn't very long after that before they had promoted with Ball Brothers the idea of setting up this Ball Brothers Research Corporation.
Yeah, that's the right word, yeah.
And so then Jackson and Stacy and were the primary movers behind that, I believe. And they went then to form this subsidiary of Ball Brothers Company, the Ball Brothers Research Corporation, and hired quite a number of the people who had been previously working at the Research Services Laboratory, at least, of course, a lot of those were part-time employees there,
mm-hmm.
Also students at the University of Colorado,
yeah.
including a number of people like Paul Holtquist and...
Paul?
Holtquist.
How do you spell that name?
H-U-L-T. Q-U-I-S-T.
Okay.
And I think his major, he was a major in physics, but he also, I think, did some of the mechanical designs, if I remember correctly.
Uh-huh.
And there were, gosh, I can't remember the mechanical designers that they had on this pointing control project right now.
This is still at the University of Colorado.
This is still University of Colorado, and some of these people then went to Ball Brothers.
How many people... were working on the point and control project, every aspect of it.
Well, certainly when it was at its largest, which was probably about the time that the first biaxial point and control was completed, there must have been at least 20.
20, and that was
probably
first
more.
Completed that, in 52.
In 1952, yeah. And I think that this... it would have been completed when the monochromatic camera was flown. And that must have been flown... Okay, that monochromatic camera must have been flown in 1951.
51, okay.
Yeah. And then I think that there was... I think the second biaxial point and control, I believe, was someone else's, like maybe a Rhode Island instrument.
Ah.
Rhode Island University.
Right.
And I think probably this... spectrograph that recorded Lyman Alpha was probably the third biaxial pointing control, but I'm not sure about that.
Even though the University of Colorado was building the pointing controls, they didn't necessarily have any control over who was going to be using them first or anything like that, I take it.
Not necessarily. I suppose they had some input to it, but I'm sure that Air Force Cambridge was the one who probably decided... hi, Kathy.
Sure.
...about it by 5:30 because I have to be someplace at 6:30, so...
That's fine.
Yeah.
That'll be certainly all right. So it was really up to Air Force Cambridge. Did you have any contact with the rocket panel people, the Upper Air Atmosphere Research Panel?
I suppose, but I don't know anything about that.
Okay. What about with Van Allen over at Iowa? He wasn't too far from you people.
I don't remember his name at all.
At that time?
At that time.
Okay. So there was very little contact between your people, it sounds like.
Well, there may have been quite a bit of contact between, Rents and Pietenpol and other groups. I'm not sure about that. But I don't remember enough about that contact to recall anything.
Okay. Fine. What is your general feeling, your design philosophy, or the philosophy of the group, going back to instruments, spectrographs, and that sort of a thing? I know that Hinteregger pioneered at AFCRL the use of photoelectric detectors.
Mm-hmm.
Towsey, of course, was very strongly wedded to photography. Your group, Rents and others, used photography early on. But were there interests in getting to photoelectric detectors, scanning monochromators, the problem of retrieval dictating that you would use photoelectric instruments rather than photographic? Do you have any recollections of discussions of improved design during the early 50s?
I don't remember much discussion about trying to go to any kind of photoelectric instruments, and I don't remember exactly why. I would suspect that it was just thought that it would be difficult to record that much data photoelectrically with having to scan and so forth, and area detectors, like TV tubes or various other kinds of area detectors were not really developed for that for those wavelength regions at that time. So I don't suppose there was much consideration of trying to develop any kind of photoelectric area detector.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
So I suspect that it either went by default to film from looking at the other alternatives and kind of discarding them, or kind of copying Towsey, one or the other probably.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently you didn't copy Towsey completely because from the article on the monochromator, you evidently wanted an alternative to lithium fluoride optics or beads.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on that yourself?
Well, of course, the lithium fluoride bead that Towsey used was because he didn't have any kind of pointing control. So he had to have some way of getting the light into his instrument, and so the lithium fluoride bead was a clever idea of focusing the sun right behind the bead in such a way that it either went right through the slit or served as a slit itself as an effective slit for the for the spectrograph that followed it, and so that was a very clever way of trying to get started on this type of a project without having the proper equipment to do it the way that one would like to do it.
Mm-hmm. But others did not do that, like Hopfield and Clearman, and then your group. You used a slit spectrograph for the, or at least Rentz did in that time. Why do you think Towsey was the only one who did it, whereas all the other groups did not?
To use a lithium fluoride bead.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was probably the only way that he could get anything at all, mm-hmm. because he had no pointing control.
Yeah, but.
And so I don't know what the Hopfield and Clearman.
They did use little homing mirrors eventually, one axis homing mirrors in the V2, but they also used light diffusers that would simply give you a broad angle of acceptance in mm-hmm. onto a slit.
Mm-hmm.
So they did use a slit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about all I know. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. I haven't been able to talk with Hopfield. He's passed away, and mm-hmm. Clearman's existence is not known where he is.
Mm-hmm.
But I've discussed this with Jim Van Allen and mm-hmm. with a few others, but
mm-hmm.
really haven't seen enough of the design philosophy to feel comfortable as to why some people did things one way, why people did things another way. That's what I'm trying to develop now.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that the group at University of Colorado was pretty much single-minded? Everyone pretty much agreed with one another about how things were to be designed? Or were there different design philosophies?
Oh, I'm sure there was plenty of controversy as far as that goes, you know, about some aspects of designing things, because people were not, as I recall, hesitant about speaking up, and I certainly was not very hesitant about about speaking up if I saw somebody doing something that I thought was not the right way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I suspect I was a little much too outspoken that way, because one time Rentz, who's very mild-mannered, really suggested that I ought to get on with my own research instead of offering unwanted advice to a couple of other people there.
What was the, do you remember the instance?
Well, they were trying to focus something where with a lens you have to have the object and the image at least 4F apart, you know, in order to be able to focus.
Yeah.
They were trying to focus something where the image and object that they were trying to get were too close together, you know. And
mm-hmm.
so I think I was pointing this out rather bluntly to them.
Oh, I see.
And and I think they didn't listen at first, so I repeated it. I think at that point, perhaps he thought it was better if they found this out on their own, that it would be a more lasting lesson than if I were.
I see. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Continuing to insist on it.
Yeah. But other than that, with someone like Rentz intervening, what about between Rentz and Pete and Pohl, or some of the senior people? Did you ever experience any different design problems? And how were they resolved, if they were?
Well, I'm sure that Pete and Pohl and Rentz would tend to probably both let people pretty much follow their own bents. Bends?
Mm-hmm.
Bents?
Bents, right.
Yeah. And
although I don't know how to spell it.
With a T, I guess.
Okay.
And Jackson probably would not have wanted to get involved too deeply in the details unless they were something very important. He would probably tend to stay more with the administration.
Hmm.
Stacy might have gotten involved more with the details of design, but I didn't have much interaction with him, because he was, I think, working more on the electronics than, if I remember correctly, than anything else. So there probably wasn't a lot of conflict between the managers, so to speak, and the people who were mm-hmm. doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a little bit, but not very much. It would be more likely to be conflict between co-equals. Arguing about how to do things on on this pointing control project.
I see. And you do not recall any major design questions about the pointing controls themselves through the 50s as they evolved?
Oh, there was certainly a lot of design problems that they had to solve, and they came up with various solutions which were then discarded as improved ideas came about. Mm. But unfortunately, I don't remember too much about the details on these. I do know that they started out with, on the motors, they started out with small motors, and a very like a 1,000-to-1 gear train between the motor and the instrument itself, mm-hmm. and then these were later. These would be reversible motors, and then at some point a few years later, they went to magnetic clutches on mm-hmm. On the azimuth drive at least, although they stuck with the servo motors on the elevation drive, and so instead of having so many gears in the azimuth system, they would have two electromagnetic clutches.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Later on, I think this was after Ball Brothers was really building the pointing controls, they switched to some big so-called torque motors became available, and they put these in the elevation axes at Ball Brothers.
I see. Okay. Another question comes to mind, or were there other design changes?
There were a lot of problems with getting suitable sensors, and this was one of the biggest problems, and Russ Knighty was the one who did... the majority of the work on this about 10 years there, from 1950 to around 1960 approximately.
Mm-hmm.
They started out with these big photomultipliers and then went down to the little tiny photoelectric cells, so that is the finger-sized photoelectric cells.
Mm-hmm.
Big phototubes, I should say. And then
They started with actual photomultipliers?
No, I don't think not photomultipliers, but photodiodes. But they were in bigger envelopes, like regular tube-sized envelopes,
so
approximately
2 inches,
or maybe a little bit smaller. But I can't remember all the permutations that they went through on that.
They went through a lot.
Quite a few, yeah. And there were quite a number of problems about how to do those designs. And then they started out, I think. Probably not at all clear how to really sense where the sun was and point it, and then later on they came up with the coarse eyes for getting an approximate location of the sun, and then the fine eyes, which would take over and point more precisely at the sun.
So that didn't happen at first?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that the first summer probably that in 1948, I suspect there was not any very clear idea about how to really sense and point at the sun.
Mm-hmm. What about feedback mechanisms themselves?
I suspect that the feedback idea was probably pretty clear all the way through.
Okay.
Because that's about the only way you could make a pointing control. But of course, working out the mathematics of all the feedback, that was done for the gear train, certainly by Stanley Miller. Working out the mathematics of the gear train, and I suppose that I don't know who did the. I don't think he worked on the electronic part of the feedback system, but I assume somebody else must have done that.
During this whole period while you were at University of Colorado, and they were building quite a few of these pointing controls, and they were getting better, but also they must have had something of a production line, were you ever aware of their building pointing controls for something other than Arabes?
They built a balloon pointing control.
Uh-huh.
At least one during that time, which was used, I think, by I think they wanted to look at the granulation on the sun.
That would be stratoscope.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I forgot, it was somebody from Princeton, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Schwarzschild.
Schwarzschild?
Yeah, I'm just, I know about that because I've talked with Schwarzschild about it, but I'm curious as to whether there were others at that time, in addition to the balloon pointing control.
Not that I remember.
So it's possible that they developed the pointing control for the stratoscope?
I'm sure they did, yes.
Uh-huh.
I see. Yeah. Yeah, I think Russ Knighty was heavily involved in that, and the stratoscope pointing control.
Okay. That was toward the end of your stay at Colorado, in fact.
Perhaps it was.
Yeah. Well, 57, 58.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were in Colorado through 59.
Till 59, yeah.
59.
Mm-hmm. So it would have been fairly close to the end, yes.
Well, actually, let's see. 57, 58, you were at University of Colorado. You got your degree in 59.
Yes, and I was still there in 59.
Yeah. You came here directly?
Yes.
To Goddard?
January of 1960.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a little more time there in the fall cleaning up a few things and writing notes on, in fact, on I wrote a few notes on some of my Purdue work even during that time.
I see. Let me ask you then one or two final questions, then I know you have to leave. First, on your coming to Goddard, do you recall how you came to Goddard, and to work for whom, or was it a phone call situation, or did you
apply? Well, the first thing I think that I became aware of Goddard probably was a fellow named Al Bogus, who is still here at Goddard, came through, perhaps along with somebody else, I'm not sure.
So he came through Colorado?
Yeah, came to Colorado. And there was some very peculiar thing associated with that. I remember what it was. I think that somebody talked to him about working here, and sometime later, this fellow received a notice before he had even accepted a job. Please report to Goddard. Report to Goddard at such and such a date. You know.
Who was that?
I can't remember.
Okay,
well, but I'm not sure that he ever came to Goddard actually. So there was a big joke laugh about this.
In what way? That Goddard.
The fact that that they must have been so disorganized, you know, that they were sending him this notice to report before he had even accepted a job.
How did you do? How did it work with you?
I guess I became aware of Goddard, so one of the things that I arranged was to, I arranged to have an interview with Towsey, and I don't know exactly how, in fact, Towsey had asked me to work for him a couple of years earlier, mm-hmm. and I finally decided against it.
Why was that?
I guess I decided even before, I was still working on my thesis, and I guess I decided I would, even before I talked to him, that I wasn't going to work for him, I think, because I remember not really being interested in even discussing it with him.
I see, because of your thesis.
I think so, yeah. Although I was interested in going off on a tour during the International Geophysical Year adjusting Dobson spectrophotometers.
Adjusting?
Dobson spectrophotometers that they had scattered over the... I think the traveling idea probably appealed to me, and the fact that that there would be quite a bit of overtime involved or something like that.
And that was to work for the Naval Research Lab?
That was for the Weather Bureau, I think.
For the Weather Bureau.
A fellow named, I think, Harry Wexler or something.
Oh, yeah.
The Weather Bureau.
But you didn't do that?
I did not do that.
Okay.
Because I finally got talked out of it that I ought to keep working on my thesis.
Who talked you out of it?
Pete and Paul or Rance, one or the other.
Okay. Okay. So how did you finally come to Goddard?
I'm not sure exactly why I interviewed at Goddard, whether I was because I was aware of Goddard coming into existence through Bogus's trip there, although I don't remember whether I talked to him or not. And so anyway, I did set up an interview with Goddard along with and I talked to Towsey, and I talked to several of the companies on the East Coast. I decided I wanted to come to the East Coast to see the East, you know.
You did?
Yeah.
You didn't want to stay at Colorado?
I didn't interview anyone except on anywhere except on the East Coast, more or less. Mm-hmm. And so I talked with Eastman Kodak and Bosch and Loam and Pete and Pohl's son, who was working at one of the solid state companies in Boston, making transistors and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And let's see, who else? Bell Telephone Laboratories.
Hmm. A lot of possible jobs.
There were a number. I didn't get an offer from Bell Telephone Labs. That was the one I was most interested in going to work for after going there.
But you did get a number of other offers.
Yeah, I think I got offers from everyone else.
And why did you choose Goddard?
I think because they were just getting started and had the newest looking equipment.
Had you met Lindsay?
I met him at the time I interviewed. Uh-huh. I came to Goddard for an interview.
Okay. Well, I'd like to... I know there's a lot of things that probably with further study, questions will develop about the early period. Mm-hmm. So I won't ask you any specific questions, but I'd be interested in what stands out in your mind as the most vivid recollection of your participation in the early period of work at University of Colorado.
Oh, I suppose that one of the vivid recollections, which probably won't sound very, very vivid right now, is that I remember having some kind of a problem and thinking about it, and after going to bed, and then coming up with an idea, and getting back up and going back to the lab and to try to check it out. But I don't remember exactly what that was.
You don't remember what the problem was or the time?
No. But if I think about it, some it might occur to me.
Was that an unusual thing to do?
Well, it was unusual for me because it was the first time it ever happened. Probably one of the first ideas that I ever had. You know, in terms of, I suppose it was...
Good night,
Kathy. I suppose it was about at that time that that maybe I started to develop some ideas on my own or something like that, other than just reading other people's ideas.
Was this before your thesis? This was during the
I suspect it was during the monochrometer.
Okay, the monochrometer work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh not the monochromatic camera, probably, but probably when I was working on the spectrograph.
On the spectrograph.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was very early.
I'm sorry. I'm getting mixed up. Not on the coronagraph, I meant to say. Probably on the monochromatic camera. Yeah.
Right. That's what I meant.
Yeah. Right. I know. I just got mixed up myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Towsey eventually did build, or Towsey's group did build a coronagraph that flew on Arabes with a University of Colorado pointing control.
Yes.
But to your knowledge, did a coronagraph ever get built at the University of Colorado?
Not until later on. This other fellow started building them in the 60s.
McQueen.
McQueen, but it was really started by someone else there. I can't think of his name right now.
Okay. Well, unless you have anything else you'd like to say in the last few minutes?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for this. I know there's a lot of good clues and ideas.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome.
Great.
Okay. And I'll...